and welcome to Dark Reading Radio. Dark Reading Radio comes to you every month with top stories from the world of enterprise security. Now, we want to remind you that while the conversation on Blog Talk Radio here with Dark Reading is very exciting, very informative, the fact is it's only part of what makes Dark Reading Radio so special. The other part, your live chat. Now, to take part in that live chat, all you have to do is type your comment or question into the box labeled your post, and then be sure to click that big red post button under the box. Both Tim Wilson, chief editor at Dark Reading, and his guest, John Perante, will be joining that conversation at the bottom of the hour. Be sure to go ahead, introduce yourself, and dive in. It's a friendly conversation and a great way to get the most from Dark Reading Radio. Well, with that, Tim, welcome to Dark Reading Radio. I think it's time to turn things over to you.
Thanks, Kurt. We're excited to do another episode of Dark Reading Radio. We have with us today John Perante. John is the president of IT Architects, LLC. He's designed and implemented enterprise-wide electronic business solutions, information security and risk management strategy and programs, enterprise resiliency capabilities, and threat and vulnerability management solutions for key customers in a range of industries. John has lots of letters after his name. He's CISSP and all kinds of things. I think he sings, he dances, he does a lot of other things like that. One of the things that's exciting about having John on our call is he's a great person and a great conversationalist. And John and I have had the pleasure of doing working on the interop security track which will be launched here in a couple of weeks at Interop Las Vegas the week of April 27th to May 2nd. And John and I had a chance to really think about security, what's happening, the trends and processes and that sort of thing, and where things are going. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, hey, this is a good topic for a radio show. So that's why we're here. And so I want to welcome John. John, how are you doing?
I'm wonderful, Tim. Thank you so much for having me on your great show.
John, let me give the audience a chance to just sort of assimilate what you do and where you come from. I know I've worked with you in a number of areas, but I don't think I know everything that you do. why don't you give us a short description of kind of where you come from
Sure. And again, thanks everybody for joining us. And Tim, thanks again for such a kind invitation and being such a great collaborator. It's been an amazing time working with you as always, and I've learned as much as I've given as always. So most of the work I do and my firm does is around areas such as IT strategy, information risk management and security, program development and maturity. Areas really helping people figure out what are the people process procedure and technology capabilities that they need to look at through the lens of how do they service their business, how do they right-size their activities from a risk perspective, how do they really understand are they doing the right things for the right reasons, not because necessarily somebody's telling them they have to, although in some cases we have to do that, but doing things that are going to help forward their business goals, really expanding into the cultural aspects in the last couple of years, trying to work on how do we make this something that they want to do, not something they have to do, really building this whole concept of information risk management security into the business's DNA or into the normal operations of organizations so we can forward everything else as we're going. So I spend a lot of time in that area, both with clients across a number of verticals, industries, regulated, non-regulated, vendors, and customers. I spend some time with the investment community trying to help them figure out where are good places to spend some money and where it might not be so good, and really kind of get a chance to see a lot of the emerging technology, emerging challenges, emerging problems, and even emerging standards and emerging areas like that of that we're using as we're evolving this great conversation.
Well, John, talk a little bit about most of the companies that you work with are wrestling with the whole concept of risk. And I know that that's an area we hear a lot about at Dark Reading as well. You know, we talk about, oh, well, you need a risk-based strategy for security, and you can't secure everything, so you need to kind of measure your risk and make decisions based on that. But there doesn't appear to be a lot of sort of hard and fast information that goes beyond that. Can you talk a little bit how do you go about setting up a risk-based strategy for an enterprise?
That's a great question, Tim, and it is a challenge because, you know, the fun thing about risk that when you have it, it's always it depends question. And that's one of the most popular things you hear from risk people. It depends. So when you're thinking about a risk-based strategy to information risk and information risk management, what I often suggest as a starting point and kind of a place where we kind of can get our arms around is developing an information risk profile. And what I think of as an information risk profile is a pain chart for security. When does it hurt? It's a way of going back to the business leadership, to the stakeholders, to the customers, the constituencies, and understanding what are their sensitivities, what are their pain points, when would something actually be materially damaging to the organization, not in the perspective necessarily of the technologist or of the latest threat of the day or vulnerability of the day, but more so what could actually harm or cause harm to the business in either a physical or logical way or to our information assets and our information infrastructure. And that's really when we start the conversation, we start asking not of ourselves as the risk and security professionals that are already kind of immersed in this. We need to go to those who are looking at the business and the leadership level and talk to them and say, what keeps you up at night? What do you care about? What hurts you? What really turns into something? When we have these conversations, you often look at comparison studies of what a risk and security professional thinks is a risk versus what a business leader thinks is a risk. They often don't gel right away. They're often very different perspectives. As risk and security professionals, we're kind of ingrained in the idea of all the possibilities. And what risk really comes down to is probabilities. So I often say we have to understand the possibilities but plan to the probabilities. So let's understand what are the conditions by which we could have something we want to account for and then look at the impact associated with those conditions. So we develop the subset of things that might occur or have a high likelihood of occurrence, and then we can start saying, if they were to occur, what is the impact of the business in a way that is material to the business activity, not necessarily material to the technology specifically or something that may be more of a focus in that direction first. And that's how we start. We have the conversation that says, business leader, what do you care about?
Okay. Well, coming up at Interrupt, we have you're doing a session called Integrating Risk and Security into your Organization's DNA. What exactly does that mean? And how can we go about, you know, kind of making risk more of a part of the decision process?
You know, Tim, it comes down to culture. And it's something that I've been fascinated and studied for a number of years now and really worked hard. If you really want somebody to build this into the DNA, it can't come from a policy that says thou shalt. Policy is important, don't get me wrong. Governance is an important part of this process, and it's an important element to have leadership support in this. But we have to offer incentive models. We have to find ways that makes this something that an individual can rationalize and understand for themselves the benefit. So if you want to integrate something in the DNA of the organization, you have to adjust to the way the organization operates, works, and to its culture. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't necessarily have to change culture in some directions or evolve culture, but the force-feeding model that we've often tried using just isn't a good idea. And a great example of this is the compliance conversation. I often say that people fear the auditor more than they fear the hacker. And compliance has become something that's gotten a little out of control, has all the right intentions, but it has allowed a lot of the wrong outcomes. When you look at things like PCI, for instance, the PCI Council does a great job of laying out the dirty dozen of technologies and concepts that anybody that deals with card data has to meet in order to be PCI compliant. But if you're an adversary, you're also understanding all those things and probably have rationally decided ways that you can either defeat them or work around them. Because if the organization is stuck always trying to meet the expectations of the auditor, they may not be looking at themselves practically understanding what they should be doing that's appropriate, nor does it make sense. There are arguably things in that standard that are outdated and don't really work for people anymore or don't make sense in all situations. And when that happens, the culture of the organization is doubting the viability or the benefit of the standard. Not to say that the PCI standard is anything bad or indifferent, thing is a very good standard, but it's a great example of not really getting into the culture of the organization of one that's more of a fear perspective. And as risk and security professionals, and myself included, we love FUD. You know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt have been our greatest sales tool throughout our existence and will continue to be the easiest path to try and convince somebody that something's going on. But it always comes back to the little boy who cried wolf. Eventually, they're not going to listen, or maybe they don't already listen. If you drive so hard down a fear conversation, somebody might say, well, if everything bad is going to happen, why should I bother doing anything? What's the point? If I can't achieve this, if the adversary is so good and I am so incapable of even stopping them, so maybe I shouldn't spend my time and efforts and hope for the best. Versus using a cultural conversation that says, well, let me work from an angle of finding things that will help you in your personal life, for instance. If I can drive behaviors, if I can drive benefit, if I can help people understand how to do better social networking, or if I can help them understand how to protect their personal information more effectively in their personal lives, they'll often bring that behavior into their professional lives as a nature of outcry of saying, hey, I understand this. It's a beneficial thing, and I'll start doing it as a normal business practice and put it into my DNA versus something that I'm being told I must do or have to do that may not make sense to me.
I mean, you're making a really interesting point, which, you know, which has to do with the way that we look at things as an organization versus the way we look at things from the security professional's point of view. You know, as security professionals, I think we tend to be so focused on it that we forget that, you know, it depending on where you work, it may be really deep in your organization's DNA, or it may be not even close to being ingrained into the organization. So you kind of have to adjust your approach based on, you know, what the culture is now, and, you know, make your change, I guess, as you see fit based on what you've got.
Absolutely, Tim. And I actually challenge us as professionals in this field to actually something a little different. I don't think we have the right to say that we truly understand risk in most cases. I think that we overuse that word tremendously because most professionals that I work with in this field, including myself in a lot of cases, I can tell you a lot about threat and vulnerability. I can't tell you about risk. So I have lots of agencies and industry certification groups and industry groups and things that are telling me what the risks of things are who have no idea about my business. They have no idea whether or not the system that fails, will that cause my business to falter? Will it be a material impact or an insignificant impact? So I think that we have to acknowledge as ourselves, as risk and security professionals, if we're trying to move this into the DNA of the organization, we also have to restructure the way that we're looking at things ourselves. Because unless you're sitting in that boardroom, or unless you're owning the P&L, or unless you're part of the business activities on a regular, consistent basis and have that level of knowledge, you probably aren't really in a position to represent risk. You're in a better position to represent threats and vulnerabilities and the impacts if they are realized. And that's a starting point. That's a changing point that often taking that view and approaching organizations with that message from as a professional is one way that I often break down barriers. And that's one way that I work to help restart conversations so that organizations don't fear me coming in the door, fear my professionals coming in the door, which is often what they do when they see security professionals because they see them as people who are going to tell them what they can't do. And instead, I give them the idea of saying, I'm going to give you information to make informed decisions, and you can help me understand the risks, or you can help me fill in that last piece of the puzzle so we can both identify what's truly a risk associated with this threat or vulnerability.
You know, the point that you're making is interesting from the perspective of me as a news person, as an editor. You know, one of the things that happens to me is that I have so many people telling me this is your biggest risk. This is your, you know, well, it's mobile because mobile, you know, all the new mobile devices are, it's insider threat because look at what Snowden did or look at WikiLeaks or it's, you know, it's the latest malware, you know, that sort of thing. It's one of the themes in the one of the debates that we put together for the interop. It's called "Where Are the Weakest Links in Cybersecurity?" And it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek question for me, because obviously all of these things are important, but I've put together a panel of people with different perspectives and ask them, you know, make your argument that this is the weakest link, this is the scariest thing that you need to worry about, you know, whether it's end users or insider threats or you know, malware or data, you know, that sort of thing. What, you know, where are the weakest spots? And as you look at this whole issue, you know, do you have, you know, sort of places where that you look and you say, this is the one spot where people probably are not spending enough time, or this is the one spot where the greatest risk occurs?
Yeah, it's a great question, Tim, and that changes over time, but there's definitely an area I think that is a logical area for us to spend more time that's been underserved, but I'm happy to say seems like it's getting more attention, and that's the privileged user concept or the insider threat conversation. I often say that your user is your greatest asset and your most challenging adversary. Because an internal user, if you look at most public breaches, and I've done a lot of work in incidents and investigations that are not public on everything small to large scenarios, usually either involve a knowingly or unknowingly involve an insider. Everybody can have a bad day. And an informed insider or someone who has privileged access to systems or things like that has the ability to have not just a technological and material impact to the organization, but also a psychological impact. You know, if you look at the Snowden releases, you look at what's gone on there, there have been some recent studies or presentations in media about just the impact it had on the employees of the NSA and the agency and how the culture was just so challenged by one of their own going rogue and one of their own disclosing so much of their hard work and things that have been ingrained into them for so long of their mission is important and the secrecy and sensitivity associated with it are there for a reason. And, you know, that really brought a lot of mistrust inside the agency of, you know, draconian measures that were starting to put in place that restricted their ability to do certain things going forward and things of that nature caused a lot of inefficiency. So I can always find the next piece of malware. I can always find the next, you know, challenging, interesting denial service concept. I can always find all those new compliance regulations that might show up. But often, materially, I worry about those who have means, motive, and access in the insider model as something that we need to put in a trust but verify model. And I'm not talking about putting a big brother oversight in place that we hide it and we don't tell them about it. I often advertise or suggest the idea of let's be very open. Let's tell our privileged users and our system administrators and those with the high levels of access to sensitive information or materials or systems that we are recording their activities. We are watching what they're doing when they're interacting with business-grade systems and business environments, not to be working against them, but to be working for them. Because if I am doing this, I'll never accuse them of doing anything wrong. They can have high confidence that I'm never going to suggest that they in some way have done something that's not in the best interest of the organization or something malicious because I have hard and fast proof that it wasn't them.
Right. You know, one of the guys that you and I have both relied on this topic is Jason Strait of United Lex. I know Jason's making a presentation on insider threat, and I also have him on my panel talking about this issue. Give us just a background of how you met Jason and where does he come from?
Oh, Jason's a wonderful guy. He's a very, very talented legal professional and a very insightful person in the legal community that understands information risk and security. And I think that Jason is in the way he's looking at the insider conversation and the structures and the governance models and the oversight capabilities of what it takes to actually put in an insider control set and a governance set is very interesting. We've crossed paths in different customer environments and in a personal level. He and I have collaborated on different concepts and discussions, especially in the areas as well. How do I make sure that I'm not invading the privacy of individuals or putting people in environments that will make them feel uncomfortable while also affording the organization the opportunity to pull levers that they need to put in oversight or to put in monitoring capabilities of their users and insiders to find a delicate balance? And I think that Jason would say, I hope he would say, that that's one of his real goals when he talks about insider threats, is that we shouldn't consider that everybody's an insider threat, but we do need to give ourselves levers to pull to make sure that we have some oversight to look for indicators, look for behavioral models, look at different interesting things that might occur, and ensure that we have this structure in place that allows us to action against them without actually having further negative consequences from a legal or litigation perspective after the fact.
Right. Well, having said everything you said about the insider threat, I mean, the one thing that I hear very frequently is among IT folks is the sense that somehow they're losing control of, maybe they never had control of their environments, but with the introduction of cloud services and mobile services and employees bringing in their own devices and that sort of thing, it seems like IT has less and less control over the thing that carry its data. What do you tell your clients about that? And are there ways that they can improve their visibility of their data as it sort of travels around in areas that are sort of outside their four walls?
Great question. So I've always advocated for a data-focused approach to information risk and security and a data-focused approach to your program models, because the widget's going to change. And I think the idea of control is something that is an illusion in a lot of cases, more than a reality, has been for a really long time. We've just gotten easier and lowered the bar of entry of how you can move things around. I mean, case in point, as you just suggested, is the mobile phone. These aren't phones. These are computing devices that have networking, that have storage, that have memory, that have application functionality. They are computers at the end of the day, and they have the ability to move data outside of your environment no matter what MDM you want to put in place, or mobile device management platforms, things like that. There are get-arounds for everything, and there always will be in security, right? That's the best part of what we do. It's build a better mousetrap. Every time we come up with an answer, an adversary comes up with a way to get around that answer. So what I often look at when it comes to the data moving beyond the virtual perimeter or that concept is start out by focusing on the data, and to your best degree you can, look at in a normal business operation, what is the ability to say where your data should be. Create an asset inventory that includes not just your physical assets, but also your logical assets, and most importantly, your data. And then follow a classification scheme on that data to decide what types of data are you willing to let go to cloud providers or to local storage or outside the premises versus what should be centralized, what should be only viewed inside of virtual terminal models or things like this, to try and limit the ability for that data to start being moved out of your areas where it's intended to go. I've seen lots of interesting tricks that people are trying to apply with containerization on mobile devices, with almost call-home applications on data tagging, with XML models saying, I'll reach back and tell you where I'm going. And often what you find is that these are very overcomplicated. They're hard to maintain and implement unless you're in a extremely well-funded agency-level model or nation-state model where you can put in a lot of specialized technology and specialized capabilities. But it's not a reality for most commercial environments. So first thing is figure out where your data should be and understand why it's there, put the classification levels around it, and then start asking the question, well, where else is it showing up and how else is it showing up? Because the idea that you're going to be able to go and ask a cloud provider, a public cloud provider, to tell you what's going on with your data and where it is and where it's stored at any given time, that's not going to be reality. And they're pretty honest about that. If you look, talk to most providers, they'll tell you, we can give you general ideas, but as soon as you want to expand to different platforms or you want redundancies or you want availability models, that's not going to be something that we can easily tell you ourselves where your data is or exactly what's going on with it. And that's the conundrum that I think we're in right now.
At the show, at Interop, so our audience knows, we have sessions on a number of these topics, including we have Dave Stott from Perspexis talking about cloud security. We have Eric Green from Mobile Active Defense talking about the five greatest threats that you'll see in the mobile space. I think we're doing a pretty good job of hitting on some of these areas where the IT folks often feel like they're kind of losing visibility. So we'll be talking about those. One of the other sessions that we've got there is a fellow that you brought in, John, Mike Zachman from Caterpillar, who's going to be talking about the CISO and the, you know, the Chief Information Security Officer's role and how that's changing. Do you want to talk, you know, you've been working with CISOs for many years now. Give us some thoughts about how the CISO's role is changing.
Yeah, so we're really honored to have Mike coming and joining this for us. This was almost like a Christmas gift to me. It was I'm so excited that he's coming. He's a very impressive CISO, and he's a very impressive guy because he's looked at this and said it's an adapt or die model for the relevancy of the CISO. And I think relevancy is a key theme as we're moving forward for the CISOs of the world of how do we make ourselves something beyond the incident response model or beyond the incident or beyond the compliance conversation within the business and make ourselves something that the business sees as a viable benefit, not burden. Mike's really going to spend a lot of time thinking about what I think a lot of CISOs are trying to think about is how do you measure and communicate what you're really doing? How do you measure and communicate how your programs are maturing? Most programs are now in place in large enterprises and in mature environments. If they're going to have a risk and security program, they have something. It may be rudimentary. It may be one person. It may be a team of thousands. I've worked with all kinds and all levels. Now, like anything else, if you want to be treated like a business, then you have to be measured like a business. And part of that measurement is measuring value and measuring what your performance optimizations are and how you're optimally managing the environment and how you're making it something that is valuable and useful to the organization. And that's what Mike, I think, is really an expert at communicating, is understanding how to translate all this interesting information and all this knowledge and all this activity into something that's digestible to the business and to his constituency of why there's value and where there needs to be improvement and where there's not going to be any more improvement, you know, how he's right-sizing his organization. To make sure they justify the budget that he has and the budget he needs in the future. And using things like maturity models are a great example of something that Mike and I have spoken about for years of really helps to drive a common understanding of something that's fairly simple, fairly straightforward, that is easily taught, if not already understood, by people in the business world and the management teams that are often looking at these things. They get that kind of stuff. They say, how mature are we? And where do we need to go and why?
You bring up some really good points, and as we have just a few minutes left in our show here, in the live portion of our show, we definitely want to continue this conversation in our chat room following this discussion. But John, you almost bring it all the way around to what we started talking about at the beginning, which is this whole risk factor. You know, as we look at the evolution of the CISO, where the CISO sits in the business, do you think that we finally reached that point where the CISO is more involved in, because of risk, in the decision making process at the board level? Do you think that we'll see CISOs being, you know, invited more frequently to, you know, board-level discussions and business-level discussions? Where do you think that position is going?
Wow, Tim, you're just so good. You're just so good at this. I'm always impressed by the way you approach these things. So I'd love to say that I see more CISOs getting a regular interaction at the board level for the right reasons. What I'm seeing a lot with boards today, and I spend a fair amount of time with board members and boards of fairly sizable organizations, they're being asked to show up now beyond their traditional 15 minutes of fame, as I like to call it, that you do in a publicly traded company, or once a year the audit committee would hear from the CISO. Now there's attention to cybersecurity from the board saying, are we doing enough? Are we doing the right things? But mostly from a protectionist or reactive conversation, not so much from the proactive. And I often sometimes wonder if the board and the CISO are even able to properly interface with each other, given their difference of perspective and opinion and goals in a lot of cases. Many board members I spent time with have never experienced or been involved in information risk and security, or don't come from a technology background and aren't really interested in that venue or lens of thought. What I'm finding is more likely going to occur is the evolution of the enterprise risk office and the Chief Information Risk Officer. And this is really the reporting path that I believe is the right reporting path at this point in the evolution of the world we live in for the CISO, because we have way too many chiefs right now. We have chief privacy officers, chief compliance officers, chief security officers, chiefs, but they're chiefs in name, not chiefs in what they actually do. They're typically slated as vice presidents or senior directors, but they're not listed as officers in the public filings for public companies. They're not given that level of authority or that level of responsibility. And we need to have some funnel point that we can put at the board that can give the board information to make informed decisions, not make decisions for them. We're really there to help them make good decisions and let them know if we're doing the right thing to manage the risks that they've identified and the threats and vulnerabilities that we've identified in line with business expectations. So while I think that the CISO is an important avenue for the board right now in the short term to get some direct reporting, I think long term it's more going to be the enterprise risk professional who can look at all the avenues of risk, finance, operations, market, information, physical. There's many dimensions that come together to really create a risk conversation and a risk opinion. And that's the direction I see happening, and the evolution I think will occur after we get past this blip of data breach after data breach, where board members are worried about their own safety as board members and their own legal requirements, that they want to know that we're doing the right things.
You know, John, this is a great conversation, and I'd love to keep it going for a lot longer, but we're going to have to close out our audio portion here. And I'll hand it back to Kurt, who will help remind us how to get to the live chat. But I look forward to having a little bit more conversation with you about this risk direction here as we move online. Kurt, do you want to take us out of here?
Happy to do it, Tim. Thanks so much. And thanks to our guest, John Perante, who has been involved in this great conversation with Tim. And that conversation is not over. John and Tim are simply going to move the conversation over to the live online chat. And that's where they can meet you. And we'd love for you to meet them, ask your questions, and make your comments. They're heading over there now. And this is the right time for you to make your introduction and join the conversation. Now, to do that, all you have to do is type your comment or question into the box labeled your post, then be sure to click on that big red post button under the box. Now, if you're listening to this episode in an on-demand version, we're glad you came, but I have to tell you, you're missing a big piece of what makes Dark Reading Radio special. We'd love for you to be with us each month as we bring you these great conversations about security, risk, and the modern enterprise. Be sure to join us again next month. Keep watching here at darkreading.com to make sure that you know when we're going to be appearing and what we're talking about. If you enjoy radio, please think about visiting some of the other radio shows in the UBM Tech Radio Network. Every Friday at 3 p.m., there's Information Week Live that comes to you with the top stories of the week. Every Tuesday at 3 p.m., it's Interop Radio with the technology and management techniques brought to you live from the conference and expo floor at Interop. Well, for everyone here at Dark Reading Radio, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. Hey, we'll see you in that online discussion.